Okay, let's start with Launchpad McQuack.
That's not the actual title of the
song.
Oh, for the love. Where's my volume knob?
Now I see what Matt kept complaining about in all those episodes of Bionic when he said it was loud. I was like, no, the volume sounds so normal.
This is incredibly off-putting because I was literally just listening to Bionic before we started recording.
Why is that off-putting?
Because now I'm hearing all these sounds, but I can respond to them. Wait, does the trigger work? I need to turn the air conditioning down.
It works! Oh man, all right.
So sad that I don't get to use those anymore.
Well, you can use them now.
Oh, it's very, very flattering that you ended all of your podcasts just to be on our show. I think that was, you know, something you didn't really have to do, but I'm glad that you were able to accommodate us.
I needed to clear the deck.
It was a multi-tiered marketing campaign.
Mm-hmm.
As in, all of my avenues of marketing have been destroyed.
Well, we can just get right to promoting whatever you want to promote now.
I haven't got anything.
No.
Oh, God. I don't even know where to start. This is incredibly odd. We don't normally talk to, like, people who know what they're doing.
No. We don't normally talk to... Well, I mean, since neither of us know what we're doing, then obviously, no, never.
That's why there's usually... that's why we record 2 days ahead of time, so I can cut out all of the horrible things that go wrong.
Uh-huh.
Well, I guess this is already the show then, right? But by that instance, is that any of this could be included? Because that's how I feel like you guys have a show, the cold open style.
Mm-hmm. It's because we don't know how to introduce ourselves and or other people, but I assume most people listening would know who you are, since even the one tweet that I got this morning was, hey, I just came here from Bionic, still like the show. Like, well, okay, so thank you. Glad you enjoy it.
Poor misguided fool.
I like your show. It's changing. I still like it, even though it's changing. Yeah, because I mean, I think the first two episodes maybe weren't, because you're kind of falling into a format of we talk about a movie or a TV show, which I don't think the first episode definitely wasn't.
No, and then I think that was never intended to be released. In all honesty,
it was good though.
Well, see, the funny thing was the first episode we didn't have any overlapping experience about what we were going to talk about. So Dan would mention a movie that I hadn't seen, and then I would mention a movie he hadn't seen. And that became kind of like a thing that I didn't think would last very long if we were to continue to do episodes. So we kind of agreed to watch something, at least to be on the same page with some point of reference to discuss, rather than the two of us trying to walk the other through why some other medium they had seen wasn't very good.
Because I think episode one was the Tarantino debate, right?
Yes.
Yeah. That was good.
So you want to settle the argument? Who's right?
So I actually have an opinion about Quentin Tarantino that I wanted to share with you guys that I'd forgotten about until now. But at the time, I was like, I want to tell these guys. So on the whole, I quite like Tarantino. I have a minor grievance being that I think that his movies can be violent for the sake of violence, as opposed to sometimes it doesn't add anything. In a lot of instances, it really does add things. But I feel like sometimes his violence is just like, let's just be violent. But I have two big problems with him. The more I think about it, the more problems I'm remembering about Quentin Tarantino. One problem is the fact that he decides he needs to put himself in every movie and he can't act.
Well, I think at least in Django, he said that was unintentional and he stepped in to replace somebody that he couldn't get for that role.
Well,
but
I don't believe that for a second, because it just meant he changed his role, because he's been in every one of his own movies, right? He's in it in some capacity, with the worst being Pulp Fiction, where he effectively ruins the movie. Although there is one moment of Pulp Fiction, and this is my major gripe with Quentin Tarantino, is Pulp Fiction, if you overlook his bad acting, right, it's practically a perfect movie. It's this incredible thing, but he ruins it with one scene, and in the way that he ruins it is there is a point where Uma Thurman's character is talking to Sylvester Stallone's character, and she calls him a square, and she draws a square of her fingertips.
I think you're thinking of John Travolta.
John Travolta. Who did I say?
Sylvester Stallone.
That would be a better movie. That would be a much better movie. Do you know what it is? It's the ponytail.
Uh-huh.
So she's talking to John Travolta's character. You can fix that in post, right?
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Like, should I say John Travolta a few times so you can pick the best one?
Yes, go for it.
John Travolta. Mm-hmm. John Travolta. John Travolta. So you can just pick the best one to put in.
Can you say it like more of a question?
John Travolta?
Yes.
Can we get that map to F12?
No.
So she's talking to John Travolta's character, and she draws a square with fingertips, and for some reason, they overlay an actual square.
Yeah.
Ruins
well,
the movie.
Well, it's more of a rectangle, but yeah.
Ruins the movie for me completely.
That why does that ruin the movie? Just because it's against the, everything else in the movie, yeah. Thematically?
Yeah, there's no like obvious special effects. I'm not watching an animation. Like, these are real people in a real environment. And it's well, not if,
except for the gold briefcase that when you open it, yellow light shoots out of it.
But you can assume something shiny is in the briefcase. Like, you can let off because it's an effect of which there could just be a big light in the suitcase. Like, nobody knows what's in there or briefcase. But this... The square that she draws, I don't get it. Like, I don't get why it's there. Like, it, all it does, it detracts from the movie. It kind of pulls me out of it because it's like, well, now there's this weird, unconventional special effect that doesn't really need to be there. So that's my my big problem with him.
Right now, my fake doctor cousin of cinema is probably, like, punching his radio right now saying that that's some reference to some obscure 70s cinema that Tarantino is putting in his film as reference. But, yeah, it's...
I have no doubt he has 100 great reasons why he did it, but none of them, in my opinion, are good enough.
I'm sure most of Tarantino's reasons are just because I felt like doing that.
Yeah, I felt like I wanted to reinvent cinema. Yeah, I mean, I still can't remember who likes Tarantino and who doesn't out of the two of you, because that was in the days when I really struggled to tell the difference. Mm-hmm. But, well, mainly because I'd never heard either of you speak before, I don't think. Or at least in a way that I can remember.
No, it's true. And that's because I'm Dan and he's Joe. And so,
oh, that explains it. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Stop it. People are still confused by that.
Yeah.
Well, because it is massively confusing. Because as well, like, for some reason, I remember which one of you is which. And then for some reason, like halfway through a sentence, I just forget again.
You could just say we're boring white Americans and we all sound the same.
Yeah.
There's Dan, where did you grow up? This is important to me right now, because you sound like somebody else that I know, and I want to make sure that I'm getting this right before I say it.
I essentially grew up in Arizona.
Doesn't help me.
Who do I sound like, or what region do I sound like I'm from?
Sometimes you remind me of Dave Whiskers, and I'm trying to work out how that is possible.
Well,
in that instance.
Whiskers grew up in Nevada, right? So that's kind of close.
Explain it.
The desert.
They're both terrible places.
So you had the desert accent then. Is there a specific desert accent?
I'm not exactly walking around in cowboy hats or anything, but yeah, I
don't know. Maybe like sand gets in your throat and it makes your voice a bit more gruffly.
Well, my parents were from Ohio, so that's back in the Midwest. I don't screw up my words like Marco does, though.
I feel like asking those questions to an American sometimes is a fruitless answer for me, because I don't. You tell me one of the big cities and I'm fine. Like, oh, I grew up in Ohio. Okay.
Yeah, there aren't really
in any way. I can't place that for
There's no big cities in Ohio. I grew up in Phoenix, which is basically to say I grew up around nobody in the middle of dirt.
Yeah.
That sounds like fun.
Yeah, no, it's very boring here. I guess, Big Potato Town, that episode never got released, did it?
No, we cut all that out.
How many unreleased episodes are there? Like, the next question, how much do I have to pay to get all
No, you really don't want to hear them. Because
no, they're terrible.
We were experimenting with a great many things, including breaking one of your cardinal rules, which was recording very late at night after several drinks, and those were just abominations.
Yeah. Many of my cardinal rules are through having experienced all of the things that I say you shouldn't do, and alcoholic podcasting is, in my opinion, tends to always end badly.
Yeah, when you say end badly, I definitely agree with that, because I think most of our episodes where we were drinking, it starts off very impassioned and very, very fierce debate, and then it's slowly the gaps in between when he and I speak are just longer and longer, and then it's just silence, and then we don't know how to end it.
Yeah, then someone gets like crazy. There was an episode of The Prompt, I think, with Federico. It had a little bit of wine, which was fun. But that was a fun episode because there's only one person. But even then, it can be a bit awkward if one guy's drinking and everybody else is sober.
Yeah, but I think the big problem was that while we lack coherence in general. It was way, 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 way worse in that situation, where it sounded more interesting when we were talking, but when we listened back, it was god awful.
it's the hyperbole problem that we've discussed offline many times, that once you put something in a recording, it sounds way more dramatic than it does when you're having a regular conversation. So when we casually disparage a person or a place or an app or something, when you listen to it back, it sounds like, oh my god, it sounds like I'm asking for this person to be crucified. What is wrong with me?
Yeah, yeah, it's that is an interesting I do it anyway. it's bad enough, like, it's just bad enough for me, as you say. It's all more dramatic when you record it, but then I guess if you're drunk as well, it just makes it 1,000 times worse.
Yeah,
so once you're committing it,
I can't picture you being that dramatic and talking. You're so nice. Like,
well, I don't know. I'm a pretty dramatic human.
I know one gentleman who's probably very offended that you refer to him as a ferret.
Oh, well, he doesn't know me.
No. He probably doesn't listen to things or read or do anything.
So this morning, I'm not going to name names here because it incriminates, but this morning I woke up to a text message from a friend saying, because this friend is listening to Bionic, they never listened and they've gone back to the start. And I mentioned this person, something this person does on a previous show. I mentioned it. Not negatively, but not like massively positively. Like, it was kind of just in passing. And for me at the time was very much just like, just mentioning it, like, this thing is kind of fine, but I don't really get it. And they mentioned, oh, I listened to episode whatever of Bionic, and you mentioned this, my thing. And I was like, oh my god, what did I say? Because all I remembered is mentioning it, not what I said. Because as you guys will, I'm sure, now know, you forget about what you record instantly. Instantly you forget it.
Especially if you have, four shows a week or whatever you're doing?
Yeah, and so at 7:30 this morning, I was downloading an episode of Bionic to find this part of the show, because obviously this person's asleep because they're in America. So I'm like, oh, what have I said? Is my friendship over? It wasn't that bad, but it was just the fact that it was pointed out made it terrifying. But it's a weird phenomenon, right? You say things and you commit them to tape, and then people will have their side of the conversation with you later on, like days, weeks, months into the future from that point. So you're like, I think about this. And like, I literally have no idea what you're talking about. It's like, you released it yesterday. I said, yeah, I just don't. No, I've no idea.
It's like, yeah, I was just listening to. Tell me again, how many stickers were on your Nexus 5 that you drunkenly purchased?
Maybe one or two.
I think you said there were 7.
Oh, did I put 7 on the Nexus 7?
No. The ones you had to peel off when you purchased it.
Oh, right. Yes. You know, I don't even remember doing that.
Is your desk just covered in different old electronic devices that you've acquired over the last 4 years or so?
Usually they're now in a box underneath the desk, although they're going to have to be put somewhere. I do have the LG G watch. That lives here now because I didn't return that. So that's now a part of.
Are you going to leave all those on your wrist so you have like 5 watches on at a time?
The Pebble's pretty sweet, but the G watch is, I mean, it's fine, but then I have to use an Android phone. That's the problem. I'm now picking up the return box and putting it in the trash because it's way past the 2 weeks now. Because I haven't recorded in like 2 weeks, and it was like 2 episodes before I ended the prompt.
That was because you had an inadvertent accident with a soda? Sorry. No, what? Wait, fizzy beverage.
That was all just a random sort of happenstance of occurrences, in that the week leading up to 2 days before, I just destroyed all of the work that I do. I poured a fizzy drink into my keyboard so badly, it was catastrophic. I was actually recording a show at the time. I was guesting on a show called Pragmatic, and we just finished, and I was saying goodbye to John, and I moved my arm and knocked a huge, like, I don't know, like half liter soda all over, just literally all over the computer. It just completely covered it. Like, I picked it up and it was like dripping out afterwards.
See, I was imagining you were holding the drink and then you got a push notification on your wrist and you turned it and just poured it all over your laptop.
Oh, what's the time, you say?
I'm so sorry, though. I mean, you you got a new machine out of this, and you were able to recover the data.
Machine.
Okay.
Data recovery is an interesting thing, I guess.
Uh-oh. So, no data recovery?
Everything that's important was in Dropbox, I think.
Oh, no. I'm so sorry.
You think?
It doesn't bother me. If it bothered me that much, then I should have backed it up in the first place. Mm-hmm. So, that's the way I look at it. I just think to myself, really, you know, I think everything was in Dropbox. I think the only things that were left was like media. And basically all media is recoverable now from its source these days. So it's not really a problem.
Okay. But it wasn't like your photo catalog.
That was all in Dropbox.
Okay.
Randomly, when I turned before we recorded, I turned on my production machine, which also syncs to Dropbox. So it has all my photos there as well.
That's good.
So I started up the machine, and Dropbox told me that it needed to sync 4,500 files, and I don't know why.
Because the soda activated one of those scripts like Matt had that went through and recursively deleted everything, right?
Well, you see, I think it is a Hazel-related thing, because I was rebuilding my Hazel scripts, because obviously that's not something you can sync via Dropbox. So I was manually rebuilding these manual scripts using this tutorial that Federico made, and I thought I would improve upon Federico's script because what I was finding was I had to have two scripts or like two different rules to sort images and videos, and I was like, well, why don't I just set file to any and then just sort that way? Great, did it, and then all of my subfolders then all formatted into one folder. So instead of my folders broken down by month and year, instead they all just went into one big folder with lots of nested folders inside, which had the most recently updated date of any file put in it rather than the actual month and year that they were in. So they were all 2013.
Oh, technology's hard.
It's great. So then I rebuilt the script as correctly, and then just dragged and dropped things. So every month over the last 4 years, I have dragged and dropped entries for in the last couple of days. So that's probably what Dropbox is doing. It's not necessarily downloading, but re-indexing, but it's telling me it's downloading. So I don't really know what it's doing. So that, gentlemen, is what's been happening on my computer.
Well, I guess it's a good thing you canceled all your shows, so you have time for all of this now.
It's basically all I've been doing is just preparing my Dropbox folder. Like I have no podcasts for anyone anymore. I just have Dropbox folders. That's it. That's my new startup. It's just watch me repair my Dropbox.
You have a webcam, a little drop cam?
I should do that. That's a good idea.
It's incredibly perverse.
Just do a screencast of the whole entire thing with the track the cursor and everything. It'll be great.
Well, if I did enable such a screencast right now, you'd see a big blue sticky note using Apple Stickies app, which says unpause Dropbox.
Oh my god, I can't believe you're using the Stickies app.
I use it quite a lot to remind myself to do these things. Like, basically, I use the Stickies app for unpause and pause Dropbox or Time Machine if I have to do it for a certain reason. Like, usually I don't bother pausing Dropbox because there shouldn't be too much happening whilst I'm recording, but in this instance I don't want it to be doing all of that stuff while I'm trying to record with you guys on this very important podcast. and I really want to remember to unpause Dropbox and leave it for a couple of hours so this doesn't happen again the next time I turn on this machine to record with someone. Or if I have to add a sponsor time code to a workbook or something, then I will maybe leave myself a sticky note. Or if somebody curses during a show and I need to edit it out, sometimes I'll open up a little stickies note. It's kind of just because the only reason that I would ever use stickies is when there's something really important I have to remember, hence why a big sticky note is on my laptop screen.
I changed my mind. A day in the life documentary about what you do and how you do it would be fascinating.
It really would, because it's so weird. Like, I sometimes feel bad for the people that listen to my shows, because typically people listen to, like, semi-popular technology shows to hear people that really know what they're doing talk about their stuff. And then I come along and I'm like, no, I don't back up anything. Or like, for example, I don't know how I have so much Dropbox storage space, or Terminal. I don't know of which you speak. Or, oh, I accidentally changed it to Hazel script and now all of my photos have moved around. Like, I feel like sometimes I don't understand technology. I feel like I understood technology a lot more before I started podcasting.
Yeah. No, but, I'm totally with you. I have a lot of those same problems. I just don't, publicize my neuroses because people would chastise me.
But then the problem is my so-called co-hosts and friends publicly treat me like I'm an idiot, which only adds to increase this notion that I am, in fact, an idiot.
Well, it's a good thing Joe likes you because he's very good at making us feel like idiots.
Yeah, but Joe, you also stick up for me.
Yeah, I do the hashtag Team Mike.
Yeah.
I never got a hashtag. You just make fun of me.
Well, maybe you should be more like Mike, and then that wouldn't really be a problem, huh, Dan?
Well, we've already discussed. I have a terrible accent, so I can't be.
No.
I feel like I'm starting to live for the Joe Steele Twitter fave.
Really?
It fills me with a great sense of achievement. Okay. Whenever I see that. Don't favorite everything now.
But it does. I do favorite everything. So it's like, you feel like you've achieved something like 8 times a day?
It's pretty much a constant sense of achievement.
The man needs something to cheer him up after he ruins his Halo script. Yeah.
I'm not gonna remind you that there's so many of them, but yes.
It's nice. It's nice. Like, yes.
We get sad and we notice when you go on vacation, Joe. You don't fave as much.
Yeah. No, that's because I'm baking in the desert sun.
Right, we need to have a real talk discussion right now.
Oh, okay.
About your sleeping.
Oh.
I need to understand this.
Is this an intervention?
Because I think this kind of actually goes for both of you, because there's something that I fundamentally fail to understand, which is when you both sleep. Because,
well, it's not together. Let's be straight about that one. He has an offset schedule where he wakes up at like noon or something, and then you see like faves start and then tweets start, and then sometime around 4-3 in the morning he'll stop tweeting things. Meanwhile, I tweet all throughout the day, periodically as often as possible, and then I'll usually fall asleep for a few hours and then wake up in the middle of the night and then start tweeting a faving thing and then go back to sleep.
That's it then.
So, yeah.
Because, like, being on the other side of the world, I get to observe interesting patterns. And I can kind of, even without knowing, I have a good idea of where somebody lives on the coasts of America by when they're tweeting. Because, like, typically, people that are on the East Coast, we follow a relatively similar schedule. Like, around noon to 2 p.m., and this goes for maybe the East Coast and then sort of like for central time zones, I start to see people wake up and start tweeting. But the interesting one is on the West Coast, where I am awake and on my way to work before most people have gone to bed. Right? So I see that continue. But with you, it seems like you're on all coasts because you will be awake. And I'm talking to you now, Joe. Sorry, I should have made that clear. You will be like, when I am on my way to work in the morning, I'm either seeing you tweet or we are having some sort of exchange, but it doesn't ever seem to stop. Like, it's just all of the day and then all of the night you just continue to appear. So this made an exchange a week or so ago where I finally had to say, like, when do you sleep? But then there seemed to be no real answer because you were awake throughout the whole conversation, which spanned many hours.
Well, that's a coincidence. You know, sometimes I'm not on all of the time. It just seems that way. It's the appearance of being online all the time. You sort of to keep everybody in line, to remind them who's the fave boss. I don't know.
Do you set alarms like twice a night to wake up and just randomly fave a few things and then go back to sleep?
No, I just happen to wake up and then I'm just like, all right, well, I'm up. So I flick through Twitter and usually it's just Anjay and John Shiji and Mike and, you know, a few other people that are up, and it's just like, okay, well, there's only like so many of those, so it's easy to go catch back up on what's happening on Twitter. Because I'm also sort of a completionist, so I will start from the last part where I read something. And so then you'll start to see like faves for things from like 3 hours ago accumulate until I catch back up with the current thing.
Because do you have a threshold where you feel bad about faving something so old because it feels a little creepy?
No, I don't have any threshold like that.
I like it when I'm having a back and forth with someone, and then it gets fave, 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 fave. And they're all from you. It's like, oh, he's reading. And I can imagine you're sitting there and just the whole back and forth of the conversation. Ding, 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 ding.
Well, see, the real trick is to pay attention to the ones that I don't fave in the conversation, because I am reading the whole thing. So then it's like, well, does that mean that Joe didn't agree with this one, or does that mean Joe didn't think that one was funny?
Or does it mean that Joe did agree with that one and the rest he doesn't?
Mm-hmm. Because sometimes I do the ironic fave.
Yeah, I like those ones.
I think it means you have too much free time is what it means.
Yes.
Is that when you use your Python script to create the super fave variant, or is that just an actual super favorite?
Oh, I don't usually do that very often because it takes a long time to start it up on my phone. Because I have an iPhone
ancient,
4.
Ancient phone.
Yeah.
You have an iPhone 4?
Yes. It's an antique.
Why do you have an iPhone 4? Because this is something that I don't understand. And I'll preface this of why I don't get it. The iPhone 4 is so old now that you should surely be out of contract.
Yes.
And so are you making a political stand for why you don't upgrade? Or do you... are you not allowed to say? Are you part of like Secret Service or something?
Yeah, it's all to do with government contract. No, I...
The Enterprise hasn't approved the 4S for his use yet.
No, I could have upgraded to the 5, and then I was like, okay, well, this is great, I can do this right now, but then I was between employment things with the last project that I finished at work and whatever the next project was going to be, so then I didn't get it. And then by the time I was like, okay, I feel like I can go buy a phone now, it was like in the middle of the iPhone 5 product cycle, and I was like, well... Why do I want to buy something in the middle of its life cycle? Like, I'll just wait till the, you know, 5S or 6 or whatever they call it, it's going to come out. And then the same thing happened again. And then I'm where I am right now, where I have the 4. But I'm going to have to do something about it this year, because that's going to be just depressing. If I'm on, I'll be on iOS 7 and everybody will be looking over at me and I'll just be clutching this tiny, tiny little black phone. With barely any memory on it, waiting for the multitasking switcher to allow me to go between one app and another, hitting the home button 5,000 times because it's so full of lint that it won't actually work anymore.
So you said that you didn't want to get it in the middle of the life cycle and
yeah.
Regret it. How often do you regret not doing that a day?
Usually I don't regret it until I'm trying to do something even slightly complex, like, because I'm in LA, sometimes I'll use it for traffic or for navigation or something like that, because I don't have that built into my car. And so I'm flipping through trying to like wait for, you know, Google Maps app to launch, just watching nothing happen for 10, 15 seconds. Finally, a map pops up. Finally, information starts to populate the map. And it's an excruciating process. So yeah, those times I'm definitely missing the. I'm like, well, I could have just gone ahead and done it. How bad would that have been to have a 5S right now?
I don't know. If you ask me, having a 5S has its own bag of problems.
Mm-hmm.
Yesterday,
I mean, it's been flawless for you, from my understanding of your podcast that you've had over your whole entire ownership of a 5S. That it's just been wonderful, smooth sailing.
Even yesterday. My phone was next to me on the desk, and the Apple logo appeared. It's like, oh, hey, buddy. Restarting again? That's good. I'm pleased that that started to happen again. Thank you.
You weren't even touching it?
It was just sitting there. I hadn't touched it for like an hour.
I can't say I've seen that one. I've seen the Apple logo many times, but never while I was not doing anything.
Last week, just trying to take a picture and it rebooted.
Oh, I get that all the time.
I've had that happen with my 4.
It seems like anything, it seems that the cycle starts if you try and use the camera app in an app, and then it crashes the app, and then you try and open the camera app, and the phone reboots. I just don't get it.
There are a great many things wrong with the camera app. There's like a 30-minute rant of me excised from one of these episodes about the camera app, to which Joe just responded in Skype with a bunch of Z's because he was falling asleep, apparently.
Yes. Quality podcasting.
God. Apparently, so, a technology podcast now.
Yeah, well, we got a technology guest. But There's also something you put on technology, which is stickers, which is going to be a Scott Pilgrim sticker, which is going to be about a movie and comic book called
Scott
Pilgrim.
That was the weirdest segue I've ever heard.
I don't really care. And so
I have a new Scott Pilgrim. I do have a new Scott Pilgrim sticker on my new laptop.
Mm.
I've started the sticker placement again.
Mm-hmm. You have to. Are you going to like plan it like a gallery wall or something, or is it just going to be like how it was originally, where there's going to be maybe some will overlap? Who cares?
Yeah, it doesn't bother me if they overlap so much.
How many volcano stickers do you have on it?
I have one.
Mm-hmm.
Because I only have like one more.
Yeah. Well, I only have one maybe in the mail somewhere.
Well, that's because Matt. He just hasn't done it. I love that after all this. Mine were all mailed out by the end of the week. The end of that week, they were mailed out. And this is what I knew would happen.
Mm-hmm. But,
you know, he's basically set himself in for it. So they're all sitting there in the Squarespace thing, just waiting. Waiting.
Maybe we should drive to Dallas and go see what's going on.
No,
you should go to Dallas and ship them out for him.
That's something I'm dying to do.
Yeah, I got a little time before my next project. It's not that far away. I think it's like 15-hour drive.
Yeah,
do it.
Just drive over there and do some logistics.
I think I have his home address. I could just give it to you.
Why don't you just read it live on the show? Whoever's closest and gets there first.
I think he's moved though. Let me get his home address and then I'll give it to you.
Let's not do that at all.
That's a terrible idea.
So anyway, back to Scott Pilgrim.
Yeah, I was just listening to the crossover episode of Bionic, in which you said Scott Pilgrim was one of your favorite things ever, I think was the term you used.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Is that because, in retrospect, you're probably about the exact same age as Scott was in the movie?
I think when I first read Scott Pilgrim, the comic book, that was my first introduction was to the comic book version. And I kind of came to it just before the final book of Six was released. So it was great because I finished the first five books and then I waited like a month and then was able to finish off the sixth book. I wouldn't necessarily say I was kind of around the same age. I wasn't really in a place in my life that he was, i.e. looking for a girlfriend, because I had one. But I could associate a lot of my own life to his in that way. Or it was just like this idea of like being in love with just music and everything that music was and finding some of your own identity, that sort of thing. But there's just been something about this book and then the movie that stuck with me and has always stuck with me. It's just become one of the things that for some reason I hold most dear in my life is this story. I actually saw the Scott Pilgrim movie at a midnight showing in Las Vegas. I was in Las Vegas when the movie came out.
That's really weird.
So just went to a midnight showing of it and got to see it and very nearly fell asleep because the movie's 700 hours long.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least feels like it. I love the movie, but it's a long movie, and it feels like a very long movie at certain points.
112 minutes. That's not that long.
That's what I mean. It's a long movie, but it feels a lot longer, I think.
I think that has a lot to do with the pacing of how the world is set up and how the evil exes, how many evil exes are fought like at the first half of the movie versus at the last portion of the movie, because it's fast and furious at the end of the movie. Like they basically go from one battle to the next battle and then of course repeat the last battle. But at the beginning of the movie it feels like there's these big spaces between the battles that happen.
Have either of you read the comic books?
No, I was trying to pick up Seconds, which is the author's thing that he's doing, and they're completely sold out at all the comic book stores, but this one I was at had all six of the volumes, and I was looking at it, I was like, well, I watched the movie, and then I was like, but there's six of these.
Because mm-hmm. the book is so much better than the movie. I think the movie's fantastic. It is one of my favorite movies, but I think that might be sort of piggybacking on my love for the thing itself. But the maybe the last 25% of the movie, it's not like the book at all. any of the books. It's completely rewritten because you could not fit the story into one movie.
Well,
you couldn't do it.
There's that and the fact that the movie was finished before the sixth book came out.
Yeah, but that doesn't really... I mean, that's not an argument, I don't think. And the reason... Because Brian Lee O'Malley was heavily involved in the creation of the movie. Brian Lee O'Malley is the creation of the comic book. Like, if they needed the... I don't think that's accurate.
I read that on Wikipedia, the source of all knowledge that is true. but he gave them his notes for the sixth book, so they weren't without guidance on it, but that they wound up doing what they were going to do.
Sorry, finished, yes. I'm thinking released. The sixth book was released before the movie.
Yeah.
I'm sure of that. But yeah, I'm sure you're right, yeah. But yeah, I mean, if they wanted to reproduce the end, they could have done. But the end of the book still doesn't really make sense to me, and I've read it three times. The end is a bit weird, and it definitely wouldn't have translated to film. And the way that they wrapped up the film was good for the film, I think. I think it was the right ending for the movie. I don't think that in either way. Like, I don't think that the movie's ending was a good ending for the book, and I don't think the book was a good ending for the movie.
So you don't think the original ending was proper?
It's just weird. Like, I don't really. I actually struggle, even though I've read it a bunch of times. I struggle to remember the ending of the book because it's so confusing. And I'm sure there are people that have read the book. They're like, what's he talking about? It's because of blah, blah, blah. But I just can't really get my head around it properly.
Mm. What do you think about the original ending of the movie, though? They reshot that. I assume you've seen that part. No?
Yes, I have, but I don't remember it. Because I've watched all the special features, but I can't remember what the... Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, I would have hated that. I remembered what it was. I mean, should we just...
Yeah, you're
into spoilers, right? It's where he hooks up with Knives instead of Ramona, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And yeah, that would have made me really unhappy.
Well, supposedly that's why they changed it. Someone saw a screening and then on Twitter contacted Edgar Wright and said that they hated it. He changed it.
Because that's such a fundamental change. Like, I understand how you could get to that point, especially with the way the movie unfolds. Because they focus so heavily on the cheating thing, which there isn't so much of that. I mean, it's a thing in the book, but the whole sort of... It happens so close to the end of the movie that you can kind of see how it happens that way. And also the Ramona thing, like the brain control thing, is not really explored enough in the movie for you to truly understand the link between her and Gideon. So... I can get how Edgar Wright wrote it that way because it maybe makes more sense on screen, but really you need to give fan service in this sort of scenario, I think. That especially because, well, you can see the movie, I think, was only watched by the fans of the book because it was marketed so poorly.
Oh, so the marketing was terrible. I had no interest in seeing this movie at all until a couple weeks ago when I was like, let's have Mike on. I guess he likes Scott Pilgrim. Maybe I'll watch that.
Because I think as well it's difficult to market,
mm-hmm.
because the story is really crazy and I don't think you can represent it very well in 30 seconds. And I mean, I think Edgar Wright was kind of perfect for it, but at the time he was very much a cult movie director. If he's not still, the Marvel thing was going to break him out of that, but that's not happening now. Mm. So I think it was only ever going to be seen by Edgar Wright fans or Scott Pilgrim fans, and I don't think that's enough for a big budget Universal movie.
Mm-hmm.
No, the trailer is terrible. I didn't remember the trailer, and I'm struggling to remember when I first saw it. I want to say I first saw it when it came on HBO or something after the release, but I just went and rewatched the trailer before we started doing this whole thing, and it's one of the worst trailers I've ever seen. Of course, nobody went to see it based on that.
There is a good trailer. There is a trailer, and I don't know if it was shown in this way outside of the UK. There's a band called The Prodigy. Are you familiar with The Prodigy?
Of course.
And I think the song was called Invaders Must Die. It was either that one that they released two songs in a similar sort of time when they came back, and they use a Prodigy song in the trailer, and it's good because it's quite like a violent sounding song. It's like a drum and bass type track, and it works really well for it because there's just lots of fighting. But then also I'm potentially thinking it's a great trailer because of how it made me feel when I saw the trailer, because it was my favorite thing on the screen.
But you probably would say that had more to do with the fact that you knew more about it from already having read the books. Yeah.
Yeah. It was probably a great trailer because I knew what it represented.
Now, that's how I rate movies and trailers all the time, is how it makes me feel. I've talked about that many times. There's not a whole lot of logic in them, but yeah, that's the whole point of the medium, is to make you feel something. And when it does that, that's great.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just saying that it might have made him feel something because he had already read it, but for the general audience it wouldn't have been as effective.
Let's just say it's because he's a smart and perceptive individual and the rest of them are stupid.
Yes
Can Mike we talk about the best casting?
Oh, absolutely.
The casting was great. Do you want to start with the X's, or do you want to just start from the beginning of the movie and go forward?
Well, I had one overall. Yes, we should definitely jump into it. I don't care how we do it, but I just wanted to say that there is not one person poorly cast in this movie. Every single character in this movie, they've somehow found the perfect actor or actress for it. Like, it's incredible.
I completely agree.
Like, it's just fantastic. Like, just perfect. And there is nobody that could have played Scott Pilgrim other than Michael Cera. Like, I've thought about this a lot. Like, is there anyone that I can think of that could have played him? And I really cannot. I can't think of anybody else. Because, I mean, if you forget him in other movies, because obviously this was something that he was criticized for at the time, was this is another Michael Cera performance. But the thing is, this is the character. Like, he was picked to play Scott Pilgrim because this is what he's good at, as opposed to this is Michael Cera doing the same character he always does in all of his movies. Does that make sense? Like, there's not there's a very, very fine line that I see between those two things.
Yeah, I think Edgar Wright said his note on casting Michael Cera was he needed to be somebody who could the audience could still like, even when he was kind of being a bit of an ass. And yeah, Michael Cera definitely has that going on.
Exactly. I mean, like, if you think of, like, Superbad and stuff, it's just like this is the character Michael Cera plays in all of his movies. But yeah, they kind of needed that character, so they brought him in.
Yeah, I can see the other side of it, where people are fatigued from having seen him in things, and so when you're seeing the trailer that doesn't make any sense, and you see Michael Cera in it, you're like, it doesn't make any... Like, it might not be endearing to other people, but I can see from having watched the film that he absolutely makes perfect sense in it. And I can't think of another actor that I am familiar with that I think could have done as well of a job as he did. Both in the serious parts, where he's being a total jerk, or when he's being completely sincere about things, as well as the comedic parts. Mm-hmm. Also, you wouldn't have had the opportunity to cast Roxy as Anne Veal, one of the two actresses that played Anne Veal in Arrested Development, of which they were both in on a TV series.
I didn't know that was her.
Yes, one of the Anne Veals.
I can see now, May Whitman.
Mm-hmm. And it surprised me when I was watching it the first time, and she first, like, bamfed into to fight him. I was like, she looks so familiar. And then during the second battle, I was like, oh...
Because I saw Arrested Development after seeing this movie. So mm-hmm. now when I see that character, they're split apart for me. But that explains why in Arrested Development she was so familiar to me.
Mm. Yeah, and that's kind of the strangest thing, because I've seen all of Michael Cera's other work before this one. So since I saw this just a couple weeks ago for the first time. So I kept thinking of all of his other things that he's done. But I still think that he's perfect for this, regardless of however many times he's played a teenager in a movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems like casting has got to be Edgar Wright's, like, superpower or something, because he talks about how he got so little resistance from Universal on the casting of these big stars mixed in with these pseudo unknowns at the time. And like you said, they're just perfect. And I don't know, generally, casting is one of the biggest places people get pushback from a studio, is that they want to put a name in a role or something, or they don't think somebody can live up to it. And he got exactly what he wanted, is what it sounds like. And I got to agree. Every single person in this is fantastic, especially Kieran Culkin, who plays one of the best characters in anything ever.
When I saw the name list, I was like, really? Like, for one, Macaulay has a brother. Two, he also is an actor. Okay, that's interesting. And he's perfect as Wallace. Like, he's just so good. Like, there are a couple of the additional parts that they added into the movie, but even some of, like, the lines that are in it. So, like, for example, you know the part where Knives knocks on the door and he jumps out of the window?
Yes.
Oh, I love that one.
Which is an incredible slapstick moment. But Wallace's face during that, like, where he's trying to hide it, it's just so perfect. And just all of the little interactions between Scott and Wallace, they're played so well because he's got such, like, Kieran Culkin has such a good deadpan style, which is really fits the character very well as he's trying to deal with the insanity that is Scott Pilgrim.
Yeah, I think a handful of Kieran's stuff was his ideas, too. I know at least the part where he comes home drunk and, like, hits Scott in the head with the keys as he dives into the bed was totally his idea.
I love that bit. I really love that bit. Because it's the way he throws him as well.
Yes.
Where he kind of, like, hits his hand and it flies out and just hits him in the face.
And that's where it mixes with Edgar Wright's style. The part I love that part where he's passed out in his clothes at night holding his phone after he just sent the text. And then it just does that snap cut to daytime where he's laying in the exact same place. And he wakes him up and he's... Isn't that when he was ordering his Amazon.ca?
Yeah.
Yeah.
See, this movie, like saying about Edgar Wright's style, is what makes me so sad that he's not making Ant-Man. Is because this movie shows why a comic book movie he's so perfect for. Because basically what Edgar Wright did was he created a comic book movie in the purest sense of a comic book movie, is that it felt like a comic book whilst you were watching it. And because that's the way that he edits, right? It's these fast edits and these fast cuts. So it feels like you're going from panel to panel in a lot of instances. And that's why I really wish that he was doing at least a Marvel movie now. And I keep referencing to, in case anybody doesn't know, he was going to be directing Ant-Man, and he's now not directing Ant-Man for reasons kind of not really spoken about.
Yeah, the comic book style is something I hear a lot of people say about, you know, a variety of movies. And to a certain extent, that phrase kind of turns me off because, I mean, the cinematic style that he uses is very kinetic, and the mixing of the sound and the visuals and the way he moves the camera is very specific to the way he does things. And in this movie in particular, it's different because we've got the added, you know, the graphics and the animations flying around to sort of enhance things. But, you know, there are a few instances where he does the multiple frames within a frame on the screen to, you know, during the battle sequences and stuff. But I mean, maybe it's because I'm not really a comic book reader, but I look at this as just a very cinematic style that, you know, doesn't really have anything to do with another medium. This is just the way Edgar Wright does things. And I really like the way he moves through scenes and the way he does things with his cameras. And, you know, the accents with the graphics, I think, really work in this situation because of the slapstick comedy. But I'm hesitant to call anything comic book style just because, you know, they have more motion or sound, or the, you know, he does a lot of things with pre-lap editing to make sure the timing is a lot tighter than it would be in a lot of other people's styles. But I think it's, you know, it's Edgar Wright style mixed in with some graphics, and it's not so much that he's, you know, stealing anything else or he's trying to parody anything else. I just think he was the perfect fit for this. And I, you know, if you look at his other movies, the style is still the same. It's just missing all the graphics that sort of amp up the speed of everything, because even though he's not it feels like he's cutting a lot faster in this movie than any of his other stuff. He's really not. It's just everything else in the scene sort of adds to it.
I always think of his style like a comic book style. That's the way that I look at it. Like Shaun of the Dead and Hot Fuzz and stuff, they feel to me like that sort of, that editing reminds me of like a comic book. But I get it. It's like, it's not a comic book style. It's just a different editing style. But with my kind of layman's brain with these sort of things, where you guys obviously see it quite differently to how I do, that's how I think of it. Like, it's like a comic book to me.
No, I agree with Mike though, but because
of course you
we'll
do.
Say this though. Well, not just because I'm a kiss ass, but the thing is that with the way he did this movie in particular, it's different from his other projects, which I've seen all of. In like you were saying, Dan, the editing is much faster, but there's also the overlap of things from one scene to another scene, things like sort of bleeding from one comic panel to another comic panel, if you will. Like when he's coming down the stairs in the public library, and he's distracted by seeing Ramona Flowers in person for the first time. And then his bandmate leans in from the side and shouts at him, and he's in frame in the library, but then cuts back to them when he's pulling back inside of the living room where they were practicing.
Yeah.
And how he's able to manipulate the space in that regard is more like a comic book than when he's doing things in his other movies where he's cutting very quickly. It doesn't have that overlap of things that are in one frame or in one scene bleeding into the next scene, bleeding into the next scene.
Yeah, I'll give you that. The scene transitions are definitely different here than his other styles. The other one that I really love in that same vein is when he invites Ramona to the show, and he goes to scream the name of the club, and it just cuts to the big banner of the club with the name outside, which is a great transition too.
Right.
But the other thing I wanted to mention they do in this movie that you hate is they cut from one location to another without losing their place in a conversation, just like we talked about in World War Z, which was a disaster. But obviously in this one it works better because that's kind of the whole movie.
I was like fist pump in the air when you guys were talking about that. That is my main thing that I hate about movies. And I agree, I actually do give this movie a pass in that because it's like a stylistic choice that you can tell. Like, for example, there's this one point where they're going to a party, and basically Scott starts to complain, and the end of his complaint is like, oh, and they're already there. Like, and it's just this interesting way of cutting it. But when you were talking about that in World War Z, I've not seen that movie, but I see it in a bunch of others, where it's like, what? Am I expected to believe you've driven for half an hour and you haven't said anything to each other now because you're now in a new location and you're continuing the conversation? Like, I don't get it. Like, I don't understand how that is expected to be a good thing to do. Like, I don't get it. Like, I don't know why directors do it. It's just lazy filmmaking
is what it is.
Like, it just doesn't make sense to me. Like, why are you doing it this way? I've never understood it because it's such a common thing. I just can't get my head around it.
Well, like one of the worst offenses, if we're just going to talk about comic book movies, is in X-Men 3 when Magneto rips up the Golden Gate Bridge to go to Alcatraz. When it sets down and they're all going over, it's nighttime, but it was bright daylight 5 seconds ago. It doesn't make any sense at all, and I hate that movie for a variety of reasons that will remain undiscussed here. But but that doesn't make any sense, and that's in a comic book movie, and I hate it. But in this movie, it's part of this like disruption of like continuity where he's having conversations that are not just going from place to place because they're talking and walking. Like, there's clearly some sort of a time dilation thing where he's lost, his perception's dropping out between these conversations, where he's suddenly in the library, suddenly back in the living room, suddenly. It's not like in World War Z where they're having a walk and talk that just randomly cuts, which feels different to me, especially in a completely different context like that movie versus this one. I totally give it a pass here.
I did
notice it when Knives is talking to him and it does cut when they're all of a sudden outside again.
I have a question for you both, and I wonder if it's because neither of you have read the comic, right? Joe, you haven't. Dan, have you read the comic?
I have not.
Do you know that some of the parts of the movie are dream sequences?
I was not sure. It seemed ambiguous, but I find it totally plausible that some of them are dream sequences.
And that whenever Ramona is in his dream, she's using his brain as a portal, or his dreams and his imagination as a portal between one place and another.
Yeah, I read that a lot more of that got cut out, but I thought they did a pretty good job of sort of explaining that because he snaps out of sleep in the first instance where she's skating through saying, you know, I can't remember what exactly she says, but that was right when she rings the doorbell to deliver the package. So we see him actually literally waking up and going to answer the door.
Yeah. Well, I think it happened before that as well. Because when he first sees her, he's already had a dream about her before he sees her in the library. I think he's in school and she goes through the hallway. I think that's...
Yes, that's when he wakes up and other Scott asks if it was an envy dream, and then they hint at that whole thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I certainly didn't pick up on it the first time I watched the movie. The stuff about subspace corridors and all that went over my head. Like, I was willing to give it a pass. Like, it was just part of this sort of colorful event that was happening.
Yeah, of all the things that don't need explained, yeah, those are the instances. Like, my favorite part about the iTunes extra, because there's not a whole lot in there, is the deleted scenes. And every one of those, I am so glad they deleted, because they were completely unnecessary. And that's another instance where you can totally give them a pass, because dream sequences, whatever, call it whatever you need. It doesn't have any bearing on the plot, but we hint at this character that he's been dreaming about, and then we get to meet her. It's the way they introduce her, and I thought it worked great.
That's so sad to me that you said the iTunes extra is useless, because the Blu-ray special edition, like the special features, there's like two extra discs and they are incredible. Yeah. Like there's a whole documentary about the music, which is hugely important. The soundtrack to this film is incredible.
I love the Clash of Demon Head music. Yep. Like I was like, if that was an actual band, I would buy that. That's fantastic. Do that one.
I love all of the Sex Bob-omb music. Like, and so there's like a, like they had Beck in to help them write some of it and stuff like that. But there's a big sort of feature on the fact that they all learn to play. So like Michael Cera and Mark Webber and Alison Pill, they're playing that music. Like it was they recorded it and it's obviously played in for the film, but that is them playing all of the parts. And there's like a big documentary in the special features showing them all learning the instruments and learning the parts and singing it and recording it and all that stuff, which is so awesome that they did that. That I just like that. I just like that they did it that way, because they didn't have to, and it probably caused a lot more work having to do it this way, the way that it did. But I love that they did it that way.
It's very clear, though, and it looked great. I mean, I've shot a fair amount of musicians playing things, and yeah, you can tell when somebody doesn't really know what they're doing or they're out of their comfort zone, and they all looked like they knew exactly what they were doing, because they did. And, you know, they, even as much as a lot of the songs that were written, they were, you know, the voices were even re-recorded. Brie Larson did that for the movie. That was her voice. It wasn't metric. It was great.
So, like, I think one of the other things of why Scott Pilgrim is so important to me is I love movies that use music in a really good way, at least music that I really like as well. So it kind of feels like it's part of my life. So there's another movie, purely coincidentally, it's a Michael Cera movie. It's Nick and Nora's Infinite Playlist. Have either of you seen that movie?
No, that looked nauseating.
No, I didn't see it.
I love that movie. It is a terrible rom-com. But mm-hmm. It's all focused around music, and music's a massive part of the movie. I've actually read the book as well, which is also very good, in my opinion.
Are days just longer in England? How do you have so much time to read and do all of these things? I feel so lazy talking to you.
I'm effectively listening to you all of the books I've read in the last 5 years. We're pretty much towards the end now. So
two books in 5 years.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, one book series. I don't really read a lot, but you know, one of them was a comic book series, which is, you know, it's not as hard to read.
But no, I'm totally with you about the music thing. That's a big thing, and I guess you know, Tarantino talks a lot about this because he's one of the guys who uses a lot of known music, and Scorsese as well. And Tarantino says the music is the soul of his movie, and that's why he's not going to trust it to some guy doing a score he's never heard before. He's going to actually go in and find the music that he likes, because he's not going to trust the soul of his child to somebody that who's working on his movie for 3 months. It's a very weird analogy, but that's
Tarantino. So with this, though, Edgar Wright definitely has a heavy hand when he's picking things that are in the background. There is still a composer for large sections of this, but there are things like when Gideon's limo comes up to pick her, to take Ramona away, they're playing Under My Thumb, like very quietly from the limo in the background. Mm-hmm. It's a very deliberate, of course, choice there, as well as some of the other things. And like we mentioned in the episode about Shaun of the Dead, you know, the Queen song he selected for the jukebox. I mean, it's all, he's very specific about things, and it's not really like subtle subtext here, but I like it. It's nice. It is, you know, very sort of literal in a sense, but it's fun.
Yeah, but if Edgar Wright didn't have that, he does that visually too. If he didn't have that same sort of like visual subtext with all of the, you know, the numbers in the background and all of the other gags that foreshadow things, it would seem totally heavy-handed, but that's like everything combined feels cohesive.
Yeah, there's also a lot of video game audio cues and music in this as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was wondering if that's why video you love game, this.
Yeah, video games is one of the other parts of the whole Scott Pilgrim thing. Is it's like music and video games. That's kind of this thing that is interweaved. And I think it's in Brian Lee O'Malley's... That's stuff that he loves, so he puts them in there. But like, there's like the Zelda songs in there. There's a bunch of like power-up noises. And there's at one point the Mac startup sound. I can't remember why that happens, but that's in there. There's loads of just really cool... audio clips and stings that I really enjoy as well in this movie, which kind of adds to the overall thing.
I was going to ask, I can't remember, I didn't have time to look this up for sure, but when he knocks out Matthew Patel at the beginning, was that the Tekken KO voiceover announcement? Or yes. Was that something? Okay. Because that sounded so familiar to me. I was like, I've heard that before when I was dying. But it's really good. Like I like that in there. There's a few times you hear the original Mario coin sound, mm-hmm. From when he hits like a block and a coin would pop up. I think that adds like a lot of flavor to it, especially when he mixes different games. Like it's not a game. Like the movie's not. Especially if they didn't fall into that trap where they like try to make one fake game that. Is every sound and everything for the characters in the movie. Like, it's obviously all rooted in stuff from the 80s and 90s, and it's mixed up enough that you get a sense that this character likes all of these different things. They all mean something to him, rather than any one particular thing.
For some reason, this is a big sticking point with a lot of people who don't really love this movie, is that they don't necessarily understand the world, you know, what's literal and what's added for, you know, cinematic effect and, you know, the sounds and the visual cues. And is that the world? Is this a video game world? How does it blend? And they're confused by it. Do either of you care? Because I certainly don't.
No, I think it adds to it. Like, I don't feel like the world's blended. Like the world is already kind of blended between a real world and a dream world, which typically I'm not a big fan of in movies, but again, like, it works for me here, because it doesn't do that thing at the end where, was it all a dream? Like, it doesn't do that, which is my other thing that I hate in movies, as well as the basically if a movie has that thing where you have conversations split across locations and then somebody wakes up at the end thinking it's all a dream, then it's potentially the worst movie that I could ever see.
What if it's one of those fake outs where they wake up from the dream and then it turns out they're still in the nightmare and then they wake up again? Does that make it better or worse?
No, that's two wrongs do definitely not make a right in this scenario. It just two wrongs make a more wronger. That's what happens.
Yeah, I think the other reason that that doesn't really matter is, again, part of Edgar Wright's strengths is that his characters are all real humans. You can understand, if not relate to, most of these people as real people. They don't feel like, you know, two-dimensional movie cutout characters, and they feel like real people. So you can you could ignore every last bit of the video game or the graphic overlay stuff, and it's still just a story about people that you could understand, especially if you were in your mid to early 20s when this movie came out.
Yeah, and also I have to say that, you know, without understanding every single thing, and I'm usually a stickler for rules and things, like, I've been watching Firefly at the request of someone, and when rules are broken, or modified, or tweaked, or only apply in certain situations, then it can usually really ruin things for me, and I get very distracted by how the universe isn't coherent, and how it, you know, is only there to tell... whatever plot device thing they want to have going on. But in Scott Pilgrim, from the get-go, it's this energetic catapult of all of this stuff happening, and none of it is a thing where any of the characters saying, oh, well, this is the rule for this thing that causes this other thing to happen. And like, there's no, like, they don't explain, like, subspace works because of midichlorians or anything. Like, it's not ruined by any of that garbage. Like, we don't have to, like, have this baggage of how it functions, because it doesn't matter, and it keeps going so fast, and through the whole thing, like, different video game things are coming up, different music things are coming up, like, they have these giant monsters that spring out of their musical instruments and do battle. It's like, I don't care about the rules behind that. Like, why would that not happen during a regular thing? Like, why did that happen then? Does anyone else get offended by the fact that the Matthew Patel demons, like, fireballed those other band, and that's why they won? Like, it doesn't seem to, like, none of those things really matter that much in the story. And I can see how sometimes people would get hung up on that, especially if it's one of those movies where everything is supposed to be so real and gritty the entire time. But nothing about this movie is real or gritty through the duration of it, other than the emotions they feel about each other.
Yeah, I guess there's a lot of stuff in there that could be looked at as, why am I watching 20 minutes of this extra stuff that is not germane to the story? But all that stuff is fun for me to watch. So I guess if you're like offended by the aesthetic of these graphics or this video game style, maybe that would be a reason you wouldn't like that part of it. But yeah, all of that stuff makes the movie more fun. Other than that, it would just be a boring story about complicated 20-year-old people who have conflicting emotions and are damaged from previous relationships, which we all understand. And, you know, if you don't make that a little bit fun, it kind of digs at you a little bit.
Yeah, I don't need another Dawson's Creek. I'm fine. I'm fine with like explosions and, you know, battles and like crazy stuff happening. That's all fantastic. And the comedy that's injected in there, the slapstick kinetic energy of things happening that they don't really, you know, like there's no physical reason for any of these things to happen. When Chris Evans' character hurdles him back and hits that little castle thing and then falls down, like the fact that he's alive or that happened doesn't bother me. The telekinetic slamming of Scott Pilgrim through like four brick walls doesn't bother me. I'm fine with all of that. It's more like, you know, like watching an anime movie than watching something where I'd need that explanation if they expected me to believe that it was real. Like if this was a Batman movie and all this stuff had happened, I'd be like, this is the worst Batman movie I've ever seen in my life.
But there is a part that's maybe a little bit more explored in the comic books, but not much more, is that Scott Pilgrim is kind of a superhero. Like it's not like explicit, but there are many references to how strong he is. Like, and he's known as like one of the best fighters in Toronto.
Like, see, they don't mention any of that really in the movie. They do mention Wallace being his mentor.
It's not really that. Like, there's a couple of sort of flashback sequences. There's a whole selection of characters that are not included in this movie. Kim. I actually can't remember the character's name now, but there's a character that comes back from his past. It's a girl that he's involved with, and it's actually part of the reason that's the reason that him and Ramona have a falling out. It's not because of knives. And it goes back to a time when they were in school together, and she is taken kidnapped by some evil guy from another school, and Scott beats up like 56 of these kids.
Was that like what he was alluding to with his sarcastic thing he said to Ramona in the after party? He's like, "Oh yeah, I beat up 56 guys and something about somebody on the moon. I don't remember." Like I thought he was joking, like being just a sarcastic jerk. When he was saying that stuff.
Yeah, but the joke comes from this story, which is in the comics.
Okay, so it did happen in the comics.
Yeah, it did.
So this is something I actually wrote in the notes here, is in the first fight with Matthew Patel, I mean, there's that slow motion moment where he's flying at him and he does the, what did I do? What do I do? And then they fight. But every single person in that scene looks in complete amazement when he jumps up and just decks him. And after that, they sort of just go with the flow that he has to fight all these people. But even once they get to the end and he's fighting all of Gideon's guys and he's kicking everyone's ass, they all have that look of shock on their face again. And that was the one part where I was going, wait a minute, how did he just make this transition where he just all of a sudden he can kick all these guys' asses? Did he not realize that was something he could do? And then he's finally tested and he realizes he can take on all these guys? Or, you know, where did that come from? Because I had the same look of shock as everyone else in the scene at the first time I saw that, and maybe that's why they did that, because there was no previous instances of it. There was no flashback of it.
I think the flashback comes after, though. So, like, that first fight, but it, I think in the comic, in the first fight, they kind of set up the fact that he's so tough. And like, because they mention like the 40, like however many punches he gives for that combo, they mention like that's his special move. Like that's what he does. Like if he gets to that, it's all going to be okay, because that's how Scott basically ends fights.
Well, I don't know how that's, they would have tied that into the movie, but I do like the way they did it with everyone just sort of going, whoa, what is this? Because that's exactly how I felt when I saw him just jump up and knock him back. And he, what did he do? Like four somersaults backwards and land on his ass.
Yeah, this isn't necessary, but the character's name was Lisa. That I couldn't remember.
Oh, okay.
You don't need to know, but I wouldn't forgive myself if I didn't correct it.
I'm writing it down on a blue sticky note on my desktop.
Thank you.
One index card per letter. L. Hang on.
Yeah. I did like in that first fight when they cut to Anna Kendrick's character when Matthew Patel starts singing and she just exclaims, "What?" Because she's so incredulous about the Bollywood number that kind of happens there.
Yeah, I really don't like the song.
No, it's terrible.
There is actually lyrics in the comic book for a different song, and they even provide a guitar tab that you could play along, and it's like it says like play along at home, and those lyrics are not the lyrics that they chose for the movie, and I don't know why why they chose to write a new song, because it seems like a weird thing to do, one, to include the song, but then if you're going to include the song because there's a song in the book at that point, why not use the song that's in the book? It was strange to me.
Do they do the same thing where he ignores the email from Matthew Patel?
Yeah. But it's done better in the movie because he like reads it, it's like blah 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 blah. It's like, dude, this is boring. I like that. That whole scene is that has better execution in the movie than how I did it.
That's very Edgar Wright for like how he handles his protagonists coming up against any of the otherworldly things that they usually face. Is like at first they don't believe it because it seems just ridiculous, or they don't pay any attention to it because it doesn't register for whatever reason, but it turns out to be some vital importance later on, which I found to be quite funny. You know, like in Shaun of the Dead, and he's walking around and everything's destroyed, he's not paying any attention to it. And even the first zombie that they meet in the garden, the backyard, they don't get it right away. So I definitely like that. I think that's definitely more of Edgar Wright's style of that the person doesn't get it, and showing that like sort of a situation where they could be concerned about something, but then like flipping right to immediately like they don't care and they're not concerned is quite brilliantly executed, I think.
So what's your favorite fight?
In the movie, it's probably the Chris Evans fight, which is a lot more involved in the movie than it is in the book. And I think it's probably because they needed to give him a little bit more airtime. Especially because that was a point where he was starting to take off more as an actor, I think, when the movie was released. So they gave him a bit more time. I really like all the doubles. I think that's a really impressive fight. I like that bit. It shot really, really well. I like that a lot, actually. I think in the book, probably the twins, I think, in the book. Although now I say that, I actually can't remember what happened. So I'm going to bow out from the book.
Okay, well, I was going to say, I read, I think, that the twins battle was completely different from what was in the movie, because I found it to be underwhelming in the movie.
Yeah, the last three, I think, fights are nothing like the book at all.
Okay. Yeah, because it did feel like, especially theirs, was sort of rushed. And while I didn't have any particular problem with the animal monster things fighting, I didn't get a sense of any backstory like we did with the earlier battles of why that person meant anything, or those two people meant anything to her. They just kind of gloss over that, so they just fight them and defeat them and then move on. So they definitely were not my favorite. I would be interested to find out like how differently they handled that, if they included one of those flashback scenes like they did for the other stuff.
There was a flashback scene for every ex.
Okay.
Yeah, and I think the two, she like just dumped one for the other. I think that was how that worked, like for the twins. She was just like,
Ramona's not a very nice person.
That is a an interesting theme in the book. And kind of you see her change, and there is more of that. Like, she's very, very hard and cold, as you see at the start, but she really, really warms to him. And they have a very sweet relationship during the middle. And then Scott is kind of at fault, and you feel more for Ramona. And then she kind of disappears, and then she comes back with Gideon, and then it ends up in a different way, but it ends in a, you know, the nice sort of walking up into the sunset way. But you start, there is more of an ability to feel for Ramona in the book than there is the movie. She doesn't really get her moment where you can truly associate yourself with her in the film, because there isn't enough time to establish her as a character or to undo some of the bad things that she does, I think, to him. Especially if you have an emotional attachment to Scott Pilgrim as a character in the movie.
Well, then I guess it's a good thing they picked Mary Elizabeth Winstead, because she is adorable.
Yes, she is, again, so perfect for this character. It did make me fall in love with her a little bit, which has not gone away.
Nothing wrong with that.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. So that's just something I have to deal with in my life, which I'm perfectly fine to deal with.
You do realize she's John McClane's daughter. The eighth guy you'll have to do battle with is Bruce Willis.
I would fight Bruce Willis, but we come all the way back around to Pulp Fiction again.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a samurai sword in that movie.
Interestingly, there is another fight in the comic with Knives' father, and he has a samurai sword, and they have a sword fight.
Scott and Knives' father?
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. Does
that happen at the end or during the middle?
The book. If I said the movie, I meant the book.
Does he defeat her dad?
Yeah, and this is because of the imbalance in the amounts of fights there are, because the twins fight happens at the same time. So it makes 7 fights. I that's the only reason I can feel like it was done. It's very strange. And it also imbalances the fact that one of the fights is a girl, because it happens at basically the same time and in the same book as the fight with Roxy. Because, again, Scott's not really involved in that. So they have him fight Knives' father.
That's very strange. I hope he doesn't kill her dad, because that would be awkward.
No. Well, I don't think so.
There's no killing. There's only exploding the coins. Yeah.
I don't think he does. Well,
or Scott dies at one point.
Yeah.
Is there any more explanation in the book about the one-up extra life thing? Or is that just kind of glossed over the same way it is in the movie?
Glossed over in what way? He gets an extra life, so he uses it.
Well, how come he got an extra life that one time, but not the other times?
It's the way video games work.
All right.
Like, that's as much
you
as
you can't get
is.
Hung up on these rules, Dan.
Like, to me, that I didn't even, until now, I'd never even thought of it that way. I was like, okay, he just got an extra life. Like, because every fight, he gets a different type of reward. Like, the rewards change each time.
They never explicitly gave him the one up until that point, though, I think. So I can see where Dan is saying that, but I went with it when it happened. I was fine with it.
It worked because of the line getting a life or whatever, because then he runs off to chase Ramona down. So that's why it worked, but I'm just curious if there was more explanation ever.
That's also the name of is that the name of that volume? Yeah, it is, but for some reason no, it's not. It's not Precious Little Life, because Scott Pilgrim versus the World is the second book's name. Getting a life is not one of the book names, and that they typically, because you've got Scott Pilgrim's Precious Little Life is the first one, then Versus the World and The Infinite Sadness. Scott Pilgrim gets it together. Scott Pilgrim versus the Universe and Scott's Finest Hour. They're the names of the volumes. And if you are interested in the books, they're now being re-released in color. So, if that's something that interests you, because they were previously all in black and white.
I can't read.
You should read these books. I haven't asked you, do you like the movie? Do you both like the movie? Or how do you feel about the movie?
I loved it. I don't say that lightly, because I don't know how much you remember from earlier things that you've associated with me, but I don't like a lot of stuff. But this one, I was actually pleasantly surprised by. I like it actually more than Shaun of the Dead and World's End.
Wow.
But I don't know why. I just found it to be fun. It was like this sort of like a like sugary, like amazing, entertaining thing. Like it didn't it didn't weigh on me heavily in any way. I could see the emotion of it, but it didn't, like, it never had the parts in his other films in the Cornetto trilogy where it sort of gets to the really, like, really sad part, like someone has died. But, like, all of the deaths in here are just sort of like explosions of coins. So it's all, like, it's just too much fun to not enjoy this movie. So I definitely loved it. And I found it to be very entertaining in a quotable sense. We programmed some sayings into our Slack bot we used to coordinate recordings, particularly surrounding vegan stuff.
Yeah, and great. The vegan stuff is awesome.
It's so amazing. I found that to be highly entertaining. So I love the movie. But Dan, you hated it and want it to burn forever, and you're so sad you watched it, right?
Completely wrong. No, I loved it as well. for all the same reasons, because, you know, like you said, it's not heavy-handed with the emotion and the characters, because I don't know, maybe it's just, again, the age group thing, but I understand and relate to these people, and I don't need them to dive deep into all of these tumultuous feelings that they have, and, you know, just because I get where they're coming from. And yeah, on top of that, everything else is fantastic writing, funny lines, and well thought out action that just looks really cool. It's just a fun movie to watch. And the reason I should mention, the reason I got really drunk and watched it again was because I tried to watch the 1975 Great Gatsby to get some sort of parody with the other one that we were talking about, and what was that, episode 1, 2, whatever, who cares. And it was just so slow and boring and unwatchable. It was horrible and it hurt my brain, and I needed to use Scott Pilgrim as a palate cleanser, and it was perfect. It was exactly what I needed. It's a great movie to watch.
It's the perfect palate cleanser to the Great Gatsby.
Yes, it's wonderful sorbet.
God, I don't know how they made that movie 2.5 hours long. It should have been like 1 hour and 30 minutes at most. It's just the slowest, worst movie, and everyone is sweating. Don't watch it.
Okay. You won me over to not watching it, but sure. But yeah, so it was a good movie. Everybody loved it, and Mike, you like the book way more than the movie, but you still love the movie. Like you said, you were watching this like what, once a month, basically.
Felt like it. I love it. Like, there's a fantastic video game, Scott Pilgrim versus the World. It's just a great fighting game, like a 2D scrolling fighting game, which was on downloadable on PlayStation and Xbox, which was released at the same time as the movie, which is also really good. I love everything that is involved with this universe. It's one of those things where, like, I both want and don't want there to be any more. You know, you want there to be more of it because you love it so much, but I also don't want there to be any more of it because it could ruin it.
Well, then do you feel like something like a Seconds is something that interests you, or do you want to see something specifically in this world?
I cannot wait to get that book. It doesn't come out here for a little bit. I've got it on pre-order. So I'm very much looking forward to it, because this is Brian Lee O'Malley's sort of follow-up, and now it's a female lead character. So I'm really looking forward to it.
Yeah, I am looking forward to it as well. I wanted to get a hold of it because it was so widely acclaimed, and I've been gravitating more towards, like, I don't know, quirky independent things than costume superhero stuff recently. So it seemed like something I could get into without it being like 6 books of commitment, since it was just starting. So I was optimistic about it. Completely unavailable, but I'll get it eventually.
The thing is about Scott Pilgrim is it's written, the format is manga, like in the kind of the book size. So it's 6 books, but they're smaller books. Like you can read one in a couple of hours, like, which is not that massive a time commitment for a graphic novel, really. I would really, really, really recommend getting these books. And if you enjoyed the movie, you will love the comic book. Like, I cannot understand how those two things would not occur. Like, if you enjoyed this movie, you will love the comic book. I can't see how you wouldn't, because it's everything that you enjoyed, but more of it. And now they're releasing them in color. You should try them out in color. Like, I own all 6 books the original ones. Book one and book six, I have two different versions of it. And I own all of the release color editions. There's been four so far. And I also own all of the special edition color editions too.
How much storage do you have in your flat? Because we not have a box full of cell phones.
And you have multiple copies of this. Well, at the moment, it's just all in boxes because I've moved into a different room. But now I've got lots of storage. lots of shelves. Well, my bookcase is just Scott Pilgrim, basically.
Wow.
Yeah.
Do you invite people over and you're smoking your pipe, sitting in your wingback chair, saying, check out my library?
Check out my library, Scott Pilgrim. Scott Pilgrim is an interesting thing because I want people in my life to read it, but I'm also scared to have them read it because they tell me that they don't like it, then I'm going to feel differently about them, I think. Which is bad thing.
Like Pens and Notebooks?
Not so much Pens and Notebooks. I mean, I can let that slide, although, you know, anybody that doesn't enjoy good stationery is like not, there's something kind of not hooked up in their brain correctly.
Yes.
But
Dan.
Yeah. So but
what about kill you.
I had my girlfriend read it about a month after we were together. Like first got together. I had her read the first book and she loved it, and then she then passed the test.
Were you standing outside the door while she was reading, just pacing back and forth?
I was just waiting. I had two draft text messages.
Oh my god.
No, I'm kidding.
Did you tell her that she passed the first test?
I should have done, but I didn't.
Oh no, please don't do that.
She was spared the lava pit.
Ah, God.